Flashback Twin Cities. Tom Osmond here for another Saturday afternoon of video, audio, fun. Tom Shu.
Hello.
The whole thing. I'm late to a discussion that I should have had last week, so I want to bring it up today.
What are you talking about?
The extremely large treehouse in Minneapolis that they are happy to take down.
Fair enough.
This is, you know, it's been a rough few weeks of a lot of controversial topics and in professional sports. This one took to heart. I want to read just a little bit from this article here, and then I actually have some audio from a past experience that same story, different people, different town. This is from Star Tribune last week. Appeal fails, so Minneapolis treehouse must come down. A controversial treehouse, that's the first line.
It's the worst kind of treehouse.
In the Lowry Hill neighborhood of Minneapolis will have to be removed from its perch. On Thursday, the city's Zoning Board of Adjustment unanimously upheld a zoning official's determination that the treehouse at 1812 Emerson Avenue South is too high and too close to a neighbor's home. The decision capped a two-year dispute over the structure, which homeowner Clement Pryke built for his 13-year-old son, Daniel. The board gave a final, tearful plea to board members before they took their vote. I would just like to say, this is a quote, that I really like my treehouse. I spend a lot of time in it, and I would really like it if it does not have to be taken down. Clement Pryke argued that the structure amounted to a special case that does not fit under city codes. He said its height should be measured based on its base in the tree rather than from the ground up, and it did not merit special concern from the next-door neighbor who filed the initial complaint. The story is they have to take the treehouse down, this ultra-large treehouse. It's very high. Now, this actually happened in St. Louis Park in 1987. This actually became a national news story. The story was called Out on a Limb, and I want to play this audio here from 1987. This played on Care TV. And then we will determine if this is more of the same.
House, and because of its size, the owner says he's getting a raw deal. Kevin McDowell reports.
Mark Tucker beams with a sense of accomplishment. He built this six-level treehouse. It's the only thing he's ever built, and he didn't intend for it to be so sophisticated, but once he started pounding away, he couldn't stop. That was about a year ago. But just the other day, his children's retreat turned into a boiling controversy. He was told by the St. Louis Park City Council that he has to bring the treehouse up to housing codes or remove it.
Well, I'm obviously very angered at it. My children are very upset. It's affecting them emotionally. They've seen the number of hours that I've put into this project for them, and they know the love and concern that I've shown them by doing this for them.
Matt watched his father build the treehouse. He says it may be bigger than most, but it's safe.
It's not fair to us or anybody because no one has gotten hurt up here. In many other treehouses, I'm sure people would be able to be hurt a lot easier because most treehouses don't have railings.
The controversy has attracted nationwide attention. The Wall Street Journal, People Magazine, and the BBC have done or are doing stories on it. And while the attention is fun, Mark is still upset. He says he will not remove the $7,000 treehouse, and he can't afford an engineer to certify that it's safe. So Mark says he's headed for court. Kevin McDowell, News 11.
It's certainly beautiful.
It's great. That's a great treehouse.
The structure got national attention. This is from the St. Louis Park Historical Society. The structure got national attention back in the 1980s. Was an elaborate seven-level treehouse built in the backyard of insurance salesman and residential property owner Mark Tucker. The city objected to the structure located almost across the street from City Hall, claiming it wasn't up to treehouse code. It's a treehouse code.
Is there really a treehouse code? Are you making that up? Because that's great.
10 months of court cases ensured, with Tucker holding open houses to prove that his construction was sound. You got to look at it. It's six levels. This is not a plywood cardboard structure. This is nicer than most homes.
Is this a Robinson Crusoe house?
They would be jealous of the house here, this treehouse.
Jeez.
On February 9th, 1988, Hennepin County Judge Daniel R. Hart issued an order that allowed Tucker to use his treehouse but with limitations. The court required modifications to the ladders, the upper levels, safety cages, hand grips, and regular inspections, including inspections by a forester regarding the health of the tree. Tucker could not expand the house but could do finishing work. Although Tucker had been giving tours, it closed for tours many years ago. Pictures can be taken from the public sidewalk bordering the property. It's still there. Over the years, Treehouse has been a visual fascination of people of all ages. Since construction began in 1986, it has been one of the most photographed points of interest in the city of St. Louis Park. Part of the treehouse tumbled down on April 1st, 2014. So the
fears
That's
a long-lasting treehouse.
This is from the builder, actually. So the builder updated. They are cleaning part of the tree. There was actually an April 1st snowstorm. I guess I do remember that. The treehouse is being repaired. So the treehouse in St. Louis Park is still there. They won their court battle. Unfortunately, it does not look like the treehouse in Minneapolis, Emerson Avenue, is going to have the same fate. And I have no offense to our friends over in Minneapolis. It is nothing like the St. Louis Park treehouse. You have to look at this. If you go to the St. Louis Park Historical Society website, they have pictures of it then and now. It's still held up until the big windstorm this April. That's about 25 years of treehouse right there.
That's pretty darn impressive. Hopefully the kids are grown up by now and are still hanging out.
Do you think Mark's sons are still up there hanging out? And there's,
I won't lie. If I had a treehouse like that in my backyard, I don't care how old I was, I would probably go up there and drink. Probably bring my friends up there, have a little poker table, and drink some beers.
See,
or
this
something.
Is why we have treehouse color people like you.
I know. I am the cause
up there.
Of problems.
And if you want to listen to the – or actually watch the On a Limb story, it's on the TC Media Now YouTube page, tcmedianow.com, where a lot of video we play on this show is. We have a great guest today. We have Todd Bull. And you don't know him, but you're going to know him in a little bit. Do you ever, Tom, when you're taking an evening stroll after a long day at KLBB, do you see these little – they look like mailboxes, but they're actually little libraries, these little houses.
Little teeny ones, yeah.
That have books
like,
in them.
A little bit larger than a doghouse type of thing, right?
And the first time you said, you're probably like, huh, what's this all about? Why is someone giving away their books?
Mostly I'm just wondering why they're not gone, having like one person walk by and just take them all.
Well, do you know this whole idea started with someone that was actually from Stillwater. He lives in Hudson.
Really?
And the website, freelittlelibrary.org. This is it's truly a phenomenon. It's all over the world now. I saw a neighbor just last week putting one up in their yard, and I'd see this a couple of years ago, and I had no idea it actually started here in our good region here, the Hudson River Valley. So Todd Bull, the founder, is going to talk to us after this break here on Flashback Twin Cities on KLBB Club 1220. Flashback Twin Cities, Tom Osmond with our guest today, Todd Bull. Todd, the founder of Little Free Library. Todd, welcome to the show.
Welcome. Thank you very much for having me.
Todd, I was given your name by a mutual friend of ours, and I did not realize that you are one of the founding geniuses behind this idea that we can put books in our yard, and residents and neighbors and passerbys can go in there, take a book, and bring it home, leave a book. Tell me a little bit about what inspired you to start this idea. And to our listeners who are not quite sure what I'm talking about yet, you might see this in your neighborhood, little barn houses, little houses in the yard with a few books, and it's a little library.
Right, and I've been told they hold between 30 and 54 of them. And there's actually over 20,000 of them worldwide. We're in all across the United States and in over 75 countries. And Little Free Library has been making an impact for about the last 2 years. We grew from about 100 Little Free Libraries in 2011 to over 20,000 today. I built the first one in Hudson, just across the river. I'm a native of Stillwater. I graduated from Stillwater. And I built the first one in honor of my mom who passed, June Bull. And I built one in honor of her, never thought anything about it. And when we had a garage sale one day, people came by it and they talked to it like it was a little puppy. They were excited, they were thrilled, they took pictures by it, men, women, kids, young and old. And I started to put a few more out there, giving them away to people. And eventually it caught on, and we've been It's really absolutely absurd, but we've been in the media over 10,000 times across the United States and also in Russia and Japan and Sweden and so on. So it's caught on, and the New York Times called it a global sensation, and the Washington Post said it's a global literacy movement. So it's been quite exciting for us to watch this and watch it grow and see all the excitement around it.
And Ty, what's your background? What prior to building these little libraries, what was your background?
I went to school at University of Wisconsin in River Falls and got a psychology and sociology education degree. Taught for a couple years in junior high. And then what happened is I started to go into actually the barter business with 3M. And from that business, I went into international business development, and I've spent most of my career as an expert in, well, like to think an expert anyway, in international business development and specializing in developing countries. So that was my background.
And the website is littlefreelibrary.org. So have you been a craftsman your whole life? Because there's some. I look at the first one you built here, and we're not talking just a plywood square box in the yard. There's some very detailed art to this.
Well, actually, if you go to our website, like you mentioned, littlefreelibrary.org, and go down to Flickr and click on Flickr, you'll see over 9,000 different Little Free Libraries from around the world. And some of them are absolutely amazing, and you can't believe the quality craftsmanship. We've been told by a variety of newspapers that we are a folk art revival around the world. And so it's kind of fun and exciting. I've been a hobby kind of craftsman myself probably for about 30 or 40 years. And I always say what a good carpenter can do in 10 hours, I can do in 40 or 50 and not as well. So I've never thought of myself as much of a carpenter, but I take my time, I enjoy it, I putz around and I build them. I probably built myself out of the 20,000 out there. I maybe built 70 myself.
You know, I think a lot of people, and it's unfortunate that their initial instinct might be people taking things from their home. They'll take everything. You put something out there for free, and there's someone's going to come by with a bag and take all of them. And I don't think, because I remember seeing this in my neighborhood probably 2 years ago, first time someone put a little library up, and I was just a little perplexed by if someone would want people walking through the yard and taking books. But there's people actually in that little library all the time, people just in the neighborhood. It's been nothing but a good thing, and people have been talking to one another. The neighbors have met a lot of people, from having that little box in their yard. In this digital age, it's amazing that this has caught on quite as well as it has. When this weekend, the big news is what new data phone is out there, and you can read something on a tablet. You're back to the good old way of just reading something on print and paper.
Well, you know, oftentimes the media brings that up, you know, and they almost see us as the last samurai of the book. But what I think is we're just a balance. You know, our Little Free Libraries wouldn't have done what we've done and been, you know, as exciting as we have without, you know, the Internet. We sell libraries and signs and registrations and all kinds of things on our website. You know, people talk about us on the webs and blogs and stuff all the time. So electronic media has made us, and it's really been important for us, and we use it all the time. But we just see, and people that have Little Free Libraries, they're likely to have a Kindle too. But I've been told by many people, they have a Kindle, they have a book, they said, but they found that they can never hug a Kindle. Mm-hmm. And they can hug a book, it's more tactile, it's more personal. It's more of when you hand a book to somebody as passing of yourself. We kind of a central theme of Little Free Library is two things. One, people say, I've met more neighbors in the last 5 to 7 days than I have in 30 years.
Right.
Community outreach, meet neighbors. But they also say that I'm a book lover. I love books. They're my heart and soul. They define who I am. And if I can share my books with my neighbors, I'm sharing the most intimate part about who I am. And so we hear all the time that people feel they're getting to know their neighbors better because the neighbors are knowing them better. And so it ends up becoming much more of a personal, tactile thing that you just can't get that from a Kindle. And so we are not, you know, negative or anything about Kindles or anything. We just think that the book has a place. It's always going to have a place. And there's going to be a balance that continues. And like I said, you know, it's hard to curl up and hug a Kindle. But
you know, Todd, I always think there's something pretty magical about being able still, this day, as a reader, be able to take a little flashlight at night and be able to read a little bit before bedtime. You can't do it with a Kindle quite as well as you can with a book.
Right, right. But it's, you know, like I said, though, it's something that people ask us about all the time. We're not negative about it. But we're about sharing in books and neighborhoods, and we're exceedingly happy how it's lightened up neighborhoods, lit them up, got neighbors to talk to each other. And as a matter of fact, I have one, my fourth grade teacher, Pearl Torgerson in Lake Elmo, she was the inspiration. She was the first teacher that made me really feel like I could do something. And I built her a little free library that I call the Pearl of Wisdom, that's located in Stillwater. So if you find her library, it'll say Pearl of Wisdom, which is dedicated to Pearl Torgerson.
Now, if one of our listeners wants one of these libraries, or if they have some books, can they donate them through your website?
If they want, just go to our website at littlefreelibrary.org, and it's a wealth of information. They can build their own. They can work in a group and make their own. They can walk up to the local Home Depot or building supply and ask them to help out, or they can buy one from us. We sell hundreds of Little Free Libraries from five local builders every month.
And so are you still making them yourself, Todd?
Not very often. We make prototypes in the office, and I'm in charge of, or in the studio in Hutton, and I'm in charge of product development and so on. And so I oversee kind of the new products and what they're like, but I'm fortunate that I have a couple people that do that work now. I'm too busy doing a lot of other things.
Well, sometimes these things take on a life beyond what we perceive them to be originally. And again, our guest today is Todd Bull. He is the founder of freelittlelibrary.org. Todd, I do have a couple questions. The little libraries have not come without some bit of controversy sometimes. I do know I've read a couple incidents where smaller cities, there's code ordinances now that you can't have, you know, people having saying a commercial business is not the right term, but
having like a public display,
correct,
or something out. Yeah, I can see that. A housing community would institute that kind of rule.
Yeah, and actually that's been some of the best, it's worked out really well for us. In Whitefish Bay out of Milwaukee, they 2 years ago banned Little Free Libraries, and they ended up making Time Magazine's top 10 worst decisions for a local government. And so we got a lot of press on that. We got Associated Press all across the world on that one, Shanghai and, you know, Abu Dhabi and all kinds of stuff. So that was interesting. And then this summer in Kansas,
Kansas,
yeah, they outlawed it. And we ended up getting on Today Show and NPR and, you know, and Colbert called and Glenn Beck. And so it was kind of interesting that anytime you hit the negative, you know, it's ramped up. Because we have often been told that saying no to Little Free Libraries is like saying no to cute little kids in a lemonade stand.
Well, you know, if I read my facts here, it's a 9-year-old boy who built the structure in Kansas.
Yeah. Spencer. Yeah, he's a good kid. I met him, and we were on actually National Public Radio together. And nice kid. But, yeah, I mean, his mom is a second-grade teacher, and his grandpa and him built it for her for Mother's Day. How could you say no to that? You know, and so they said no to him, and the media just went crazy over it. And actually saying no to Little Free Library in the community usually doesn't work out too well for the community.
Well, I'm totally right. That does sound like, actually, a cartoon that I watched recently that had them putting a rider on a congressional bill for flags for orphans. Like, no one can possibly vote against this. To do that is just a terrible idea.
You don't want to be the guy that's stopping Free Little Library. I'm guessing in Leawood, Kansas, and in Whitefish Bay, there was not issues with large riots of people at these little neighborhood book areas causing trouble. It's probably mostly people that need something to say no to.
Well, yeah, and what ended up happening is they tried to say it was an outside structure that needed like a permit. And people look at it and say, you know, it's like a doghouse or a birdhouse. And if you call it that, you know, calling that, you know, I'm not sure the city ordinance makes you take out a building permit for your doghouse. I guess if it's big enough, it would.
And Todd, have you has your organization partnered with libraries and communities? I know that there also could be sometimes, you know, libraries need people to go into them to sustain them. Have you had any challenges with either seeing as a competitor to standard libraries, or have you partnered with them?
Libraries are our single biggest fan, biggest customers. They buy more from us. They work with us, and we are frequently on October 8th, I'm a keynote speaker at the Minnesota Library Convention in Mankato. And so there are big fans, and matter of fact, last year we won an award called the Movers and Shakers Award from the American Library Association, which is their top award for being thought leaders in the library industry, which, you know, we smile at. We're happy that there are fans because we think of ourselves almost as a branch of a branch of a library, and we think a lot of times we just are a really nice spark that gets kids and people excited, and we find that the libraries constantly are buying our little free libraries, like the library in Anchorage in Alaska bought 14 of them and put them in little communities around Anchorage.
Wow.
And so we have that happening all the time as libraries and school libraries in the same way. And we're connected with them a bunch, and we're doing all kinds of things that are expanding programs with school libraries and public libraries. Matter of fact, we have a program in Minneapolis called Books Around the Block, where we put books in kids' hands wherever they may be, concentrating mainly in North Minneapolis, where there's a huge black-white education gap. We put in 40 libraries we donated, Little Free Library donated them, to the school district. And we found that there were over 200 more Little Free Libraries behind us from 4-H, from Lions Club, from Rotaries, from schools, from the University of Minnesota, groups of attorneys had build days, General Mills, 3M. And so we find that once we start a momentum, especially like that program with Books Around the Block, we get more and more. We're giving away up to 100 Little Free Libraries on October 8th in Chicago. I've got another group giving away some libraries in L.A. We've given out libraries in Florida. We're going to give away a bunch of libraries in Detroit and start a big push there. And what's kind of neat is once the motion starts in a community, it's like in Minnesota. And we had 5 Little Free Libraries in September of 2011. Now we have over 2,000 libraries in Minnesota. So it's quickly expanded, and people have grabbed onto it and made it their own, and it's exciting. And if you get a chance to, like I said, look them at the website, look at Flickr, you'd just be amazed. They're all over the world in all kinds of colors, all kinds of places, and it's taken, you know, the world by storm. It's really cool, and it just makes us happy to see that, you know, conversations are opening up more and more, and the conversations around community and a book. And that's about as cool as you can get in my mind.
Todd, when you look at this and you look at what it's become after that first library you built in honor of your mom, are you amazed at what became of this?
I'm amazed at what became of this, and I'm amazed at what's becoming of this. I just got back from Japan and the Philippines, where I was on a speaking tour. I can't keep up with the speaking tours I'm asked to go to in Brazil and Belgium and different places. And what people are asking us to do is to put together forums where we bring together grassroots literacy movements around different places around the world that are affecting communities and making change. You know, because when we have so many literacy problems, we have so many concerns about reading, and we know that the school systems and the structures we have can't handle it. Mm-hmm. We know that they need help from the community. And what we're finding that Little Free Library is ending up becoming is a banner that's saying, look, you know, we're going to make sure every kid in our block reads. We're starting a program called A Literacy Friendly Neighborhood. And the idea behind it is that every kid in our block is going to read, and we're setting up some satellites to do that. And the idea behind it is that the neighborhoods are saying, we're going to make sure every kid reads. We're going to make sure that this is effective. You know, in Los Angeles, the police department gives away little free libraries. And one of the things they say is little free libraries help prevent crime. You think, wow, that's bold. And they say, no. 85% of the kids that go before the juvenile court system in Los Angeles are functionally literate.
Mm-hmm.
And they went on to say it makes a total jobs, drugs, you know, crime, all directly related to literacy. And when many states around the country, what they do is they look at the literacy rates of second and third graders to determine the prison population, you know, 10 and 15 years from now. In Ohio, they have a new law that says kids can't go from third grade to fourth grade unless they pass the minimum reading standards. In Cleveland, 75% of the kids are going to fail, 75%. And we know we're not going to throw a lot more money at it. We're not going to have a lot more resources to make the change. And the only way you could really do it is if the neighborhoods start to say, hey, I'm going to make a difference. Everybody in my block, in my neighborhood, is going to read, and I'm going to make sure it happens. So what we're really excited is we're seeing that we're kind of taking a lead in really a grassroots literacy movement. We hear from people in Brazil, we hear from people in Japan, from the Philippines, we hear from people around the world about how they're trying to do something like this, use little free libraries to adapt to their country, to their neighborhood, wherever they are, and use it as a way to move literacy forward in their community. And so that's what's really exciting for us, is that, you know, this little small box out of a house in Wisconsin has grown to a global phenomenon. And Madison has asked for the first little free library I have in Hudson to put in the museum in Madison as a cultural icon. And I think that's pretty special. But, you know, the part that's coolest is that it's really local neighbors, thousands of them around the world, stepping up and saying that they're going to fix their neighborhood and their community and make it better. And that's about as good as it gets in my mind.
No, you know what? It's great.
I'll tell you something. You know what this reminds me of, and part of the reason I did this, and this is really relevant for the Stillwater community, is I've worked on the dikes as a kid growing up and as an adult, you know, still in the sandbags. And what was so interesting is you fill sandbags, and everybody gets along. Everybody appreciates everybody, and they're so happy that they're there together to help the community. And so I sometimes will say, a little free library is like a flood without a flood. You know, it's that coming together under a common ground of a community to make the community better. And it's such a wonderful feeling for, you know, fellow Stillwaterites that have worked the floods. They know exactly what I'm talking about.
And I don't think
it's a... Go ahead.
No, you. I don't think anyone will disagree that, first of all, your point about education... having, whether you're Republican, Democrat, Independent, whatever it is, you need to be able to read. You need to be able to be educated to get an education, and that's going to prevent a lot of problems in society. And the second piece to your sandbag analogy, which after this year is a very good analogy considering the year we've had. You know, we need more reasons to get together, not just in the incident of, you know, the dire need, but in the instance of, you know, coming together as a community because it is a good time to come together, not because we have to do.
Well, do you think these communities are seeing this as, you know, like a flood is an emergency? This is just an educational emergency, and the towns are realizing we need to do something.
I never articulated it that way, but that's a very good point. I think that's a good way. Well, a quick story. As I was in... the former job I had is I had a nursing scholarship organization, put nurses through graduate school. And I was in Bombay, India, and I was in a room full of 50 patients, one nurse. And I said, how could you possibly, bad conditions, horrible conditions. I said, how can you possibly take care of these patients? She said, I can't. We don't have enough money. We don't have enough resources. We don't have enough help. But she said, see all these other people that are next to the patients? Those are family members, loved ones, and neighbors. I teach them what to do as best as I can, and they take care of the patients. And she said, you would be surprised how well we do in India with watchers who watch over the patients. And I realized what she was saying is we don't have enough resources to handle all the problems that we have with literacy. We don't have all the tutors we need. The only thing that we have that is really out there that can make a difference is the neighbors, the watchers, to help each other.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think, you know, it just has to be, people stop saying, you know, our schools aren't doing their job and they're not doing their job or the government aren't putting enough money in education. And the neighbor has to start reading a book down at the local grade school, like the, you know, at the high school, or start to help out and start to fix and change things, you know, because the only way, quote, you know, we're going to, quote, reach that American dream, whatever somebody's idea of American dream is if you read well and read often, you know. By the way, as a side note, I'm from the graduating class of 1974 in Stillwater, and we just had our 40th reunion, and we did put together a little free library that that is pictures of Stillwater, old Stillwater, that we are going to dedicate it to the city of Stillwater.
That's great. That's really, that's
so
fantastic.
So you'll see that around.
That's fantastic. You know, I have to say I appreciate you being able to be on today, because considering you're speaking across the globe right now, and we were able to put this interview together rather quickly. I appreciate that. I do have a couple more questions.
Can I jump in real quick?
Please, Tom.
I do have one question for you.
I have to say, before you continue,
oh, sure,
that there's nothing fonder for me than where I grew up and where my heart is than in the St. Croix Valley.
It's tough to leave this place.
Yeah.
So my question is, down, you know, in the Twin Cities years ago, they would have the free bikes that people could just pick up. They could ride, and you were supposed to just drop them off at another kind of bike stand where they offered the free bikes. They weren't marked or anything like that. They do have those now, but they are marked, and very obviously those kind of bikes. What is it that's keeping people from stealing these books? I know we touched on the crime issue a little bit earlier, but why are they not being basically just disappearing?
Well, the first and foremost fundamental thing is you can't steal free. So it's an oxymoron, right?
Well,
So the only thing that, and so what happens sometimes, though, is sometimes there's some budding entrepreneur that decides that they want to, you know, take more than their share of books.
Sure.
And so we have a stamp that goes on the library that says, excuse me, on the book that says, always a gift, never for sale.
Ah.
And we often communicate with the local used bookstores that, hey, this is our stamp. You know, it's what it says, always a gift, never for sale. Know that somebody's taken it from a little free library and tried to sell it to you.
Gotcha.
So it makes it so they don't want to buy it, and it also makes the aware consumer like, why are you selling me a free book? You know, I mean,
smart idea. That is an excellent idea.
But I sat for hours trying to figure out what could I say on a stamp that communicated that.
There's still some conscience out there, luckily. There's still some people that might actually see that stamp and actually might develop a conscience. But I think really, and this might just my assumption, and I of course had the first assumption or first cynical, and I hate to say it, a cynical point of view when I saw it first in my neighborhood too. Like, what's with this? But if you're going to be a criminal, and if you're going to get into taking commodities to sell, books is probably not going to be where you're going to start. Like, casing the little free libraries might not be the most profitable thing to do. As a person who's read a lot of books and tried to sell books to half-price books, it's not going to keep you eating very long.
True.
No, but also the most important part about this whole discussion right now is that the library is the communities.
Right. Right.
It's the neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. And so we have directions and instructions on how to have a grand opening and how to communicate with your neighbors. Here's a flyer you can send out. And you go to your neighbors within five blocks to say, hey, can we get a book for the little free library we're just opening? Sure. And so the whole neighborhood doesn't feel that it's your library that you're giving to the community. It's theirs. It's their whole neighborhoods. So the more that they have a sense that it's the whole neighborhood library, the better it is. We have some of them in the roughest parts of Minneapolis, and we don't have any problems at all. We have some very ornate libraries that have been there for a couple of years, and nothing happens. You know, because the community says, well, wait, Grandma Smith, those are her books. Or, wait a minute, those are some of the books I had when I was a kid. You know, and so the neighborhood, not only that, but we also encourage the neighborhood to watch over it and take care of it as it fits theirs, you know, the whole neighborhood.
Well,
so I
say,
think that sense.
You're making me feel better about America, because I know you're over in you're over in Japan, and that's the only kind of place that I could envision something like just on the sidewalk for free, and everyone would respect it. And the fact that it's actually working out here, I mean, thank you.
Todd,
we're in 75 countries, though. I mean, we're not just, you know, we're in Germany and Netherlands, yeah, and Australia and Ghana and Nigeria and Uganda, Albania. You know, so it's not. And I just got a contact from China, a group that wants to start it up across China. So it's, you know, I think neighbors and community want to get along and work together everywhere, really.
Todd, when our audience wants to contribute to Little Free Library, what does their donations go to?
Well, we are a nonprofit,
right,
and we put up hundreds and hundreds of libraries and signs and install them all around the country, mainly in the United States. And we try to push our mission, and we try to build off of what Martin Luther King said, if you're going to die tomorrow, what would you do? And you'd plant a seed to make a difference. And so we're out there planting seeds and giving Little Free Libraries away after Hurricane Sandy, after the tornadoes in Joplin, after the last hurricane in New Orleans. You know, we give them out all across the country, and especially we give them here in the Twin Cities. And so they support the mission. They support getting libraries in people's hands who need them the most, and that's what it does.
Well, Todd, I think you're going to get a lot of support from the people here in Stillwater, Minneapolis, St. Paul, and who listen to the podcast after this this discussion today. LittleFreeLibrary.org, Todd Bull, the founder of Little Free Library. Todd, in 5 years to be such a global phenomenon, that's incredible. I have to use the word surprising and amazing again, but that's great. The fact that the Museum of Wisconsin wants to put the first one in a museum after a few years, that's not all bad.
Well, it is, but it's wonderful. It's wonderful. And it's a thrill. But, you know, it's the real thing is if you look at an email from me or my business card, it says Todd Bull, First Steward. And what I feel about is I represent all the stewards, the thousands of them around the world that take care of the Little Free Libraries. So success is really about all of these stewards, all of these communities that are stepping up to make the change. That's what's the real exciting part. You know, we planted a seed well, and others start to, you know, come to it. I've told people that I feel somewhat like Dorothy when she discovered the Tin Man. All I did was put a little oil in the Tin Man, and he started to dance, and he started to dance all around the world with the Little Free Library. So I think that's where the excitement is.
Todd, you know, this is great. I appreciate your time today. We have to actually go to a break, unfortunately, but you're again, littlefreelibrary.org, Todd Bull, the founder. And if you're interested in getting your own Little Free Library, interested in either donating or getting in touch, they can do it on the website. There's some great photos there, Todd, of you in Africa, actually, with some looks like you're providing some libraries to some other countries. This is great.
Thanks a lot. I really appreciate it. It's always great to speak to media, especially in the Stillwater Valley.
Well, we'll do it again.
Thanks.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks a lot. Bye.
Flashback Twin Cities. Tom Osmond here for the last segment of this Saturday afternoon, Saturday, September 20th. Tom, you, I imagine, have been to many weddings.
Yeah.
In your life.
Yeah.
You
get those summers where you end up going to like five or six weddings in a year.
And I was actually, we actually had a joke recently. I was talking to a friend about a wedding experience. I said I had wedding meat. I can't even remember what the, I think it was a beef dish. But you know that wedding beef that's at every single wedding reception you've been to?
And sure.
It's not steak, but it's not, there's just a very interesting texture to it. I should call it wedding meat.
It's kind of like jerky.
Yeah.
Beef jerky steak.
Yeah.
I know what you're talking
potatoes,
about.
It's the green beans. It's wedding food if it's not buffet.
Oh, I love buffet.
Every wedding has staples. You have, especially if you have the spirits flowing, mm-hmm. you have people that take too many spirits. And then when it gets to the dance party at the night, and I in a past life, I might have provided some music and entertainment at weddings at one point in my life every Saturday for a long time.
I did not know
there are staple songs. And the songs become so staple that when you go to a wedding, if you go to one wedding every 2 years, every 3 years, every 5 years, it's not as cliche when you're at a wedding and you hear the same songs every single time. What comes to mind? The Limbo or
Shout.
Shout. Exactly. One song, which I don't think has quite fallen into the cliche, but you hear it at a lot of weddings. And this is a article from NPR, and I know we don't acknowledge your existence sometimes.
Can I take a wild guess real fast?
Yes.
Is this Sting?
No.
Oh,
it's not.
All right.
Tomorrow is September 21st, and September 21st is referenced in the Earth, Wind, Fire song, September. So this is from Dan Charnas at NPR. If you've ever been to a wedding reception in the U.S., you know there's one question that can get a whole family on the dance floor. Do you remember the 21st night of September? I'm not going to sing. Earth, Wind, and Fire September even shows up at the fictional weddings as in the opening of the 1997 movie Soul Food. It's made its way into TV shows, commercials, sporting events, and video games. HBO named a movie after the song. In 2008, it played at both the Republican and Democratic National Conventions. Well, look at that. Both stripes like this song.
Everyone does.
The story of the song begins in 1978. Ollie Williams was a struggling songwriter in L.A. until the night she got a call from Maurice White, the leader of Earth, Wind & Fire. White offered her the chance of a lifetime to co-write the band's next album. Willis arrived at the studio the next day, hoping it wasn't some kind of cosmic joke. End quote. As I opened the door, they had just written the intro to September, and I just thought, dear God, let this be what they want me to write, because it's obviously the happiest sounding song in the world, Willis says. Using a progression composed by Earth, Wind, and Fire guitarist Al McKay, White and Willis wrote the song over the course of a month, conjuring images of clear skies and dancing under the stars. Willis says she likes the songs that tell stories and that at a certain point she feared the lyrics to September were starting to sound simplistic. One nonsense phrase bugged her in particular. Now, I'm going to quote this song. I'm not going to sing it. You can hum along if you'd like
to. I want you to sing it, Tom.
The kind of go-to phrase that Maurice used in every song he wrote was Badia, she says. So right from the beginning, we're singing Badia, do you remember? Badia, dancing in September.
Where he does the falsetto. Oh,
that's right. Badia! Thank you. You're the dancer of the group here. And I said, "What? We are going to change Badia to real words, right?" Wrong. Willis says, at the final vocal session, she got desperate and begged Willie to rewrite the part. And finally, when it was so obvious that he was not going to do it, I just said, I'm going to change some words here. What the heck does Badia mean? And he essentially said, who the heck cares? I learned my greatest lesson ever in songwriting from him, which was never let the lyric get in the way of a groove. Look at that.
That's very true. You can ask any artist with like the Ramalama Ding Dong or Doobie Doobie Doobie.
I asked Jeffrey Peretz, a professor of music theory at New York University's Clive Davis Institute, what makes the groove so powerful. He says a lot has to do with how music unfolds. The song's very structure is an endless cycle that keeps us dancing and wanting more. There's four chords in the chorus that just keep moving forward and never seem to land anywhere. Much like the four seasons, he says, it's the end of summer, it's the beginning of fall, it's that Indian summertime, it's a transition from warm to cool. The trigger for the yearning feeling, Peretz says, is the opening line. White asks, do you remember? And we supply the memories. It's a song that can bring all the generations together, which makes it perfect for family gatherings. The true meaning is up to us, including, Ollie Williams says, that strangely specific date. We went through all the dates, and do you remember the first, the second, the third, the fourth, and the one that just felt the best was the 21st, Willis explains. I constantly have people coming up to me, and they get so excited to know that the significance was, and there is no significance beyond just saying better than any of the other dates. So sorry. That's okay. Ollie, Maurice is right. It doesn't matter what it means. When we hear it, it's September 21st, and we are dancing again with our family in a song that never really ends. And that's true. That song does not end. I think it's about an 8-minute song. But as a treat on the September 20th, the eve of September 21st, we're going to end the Flashback Twin Cities program here with Earth, Wind, and Fire's September, one of my favorite songs. I'm going to call on Stan's show next week and request this, I think.
Do it, please. I'd love that. And actually, you reminded me very much of last year. my best friend's sister, she got married, Maggie. And I inadvertently became a last-minute MC. So I was running the music and announcing, you know, the groomsmen and the bridesmaids as they're walking down the aisle and the music, or down the, to the reception. And the song I had to play when they started walking down?
September.
That was the one. All of a sudden.
You know, it's not a groaner song. There's so many wedding songs that are groaners.
No, no.
This is a staple of wedding songs, just not a groaner.
You know, there's a lot of them, yeah. They pop on, you're like, oh, this again? Really? Oh, well.
When I emceed these events, people used to come up to me after they'd had their spirits. They would say, hey, can I have the microphone? I said, I have a policy on a microphone at weddings. I don't give it out.
It's a smart decision.
Nothing good comes from that. There's just some things you learn. Nothing good comes from that. The first couple times I emceed a wedding, that was a decision I thought I should do. And then it turned out to be a poor decision because occasionally you get this American Idol tendency where you think you're a great performer and you think that people actually want to hear what you have to say. I have this little audio I want to play here. This is someone poorly doing the song we're going to play today. Oh, she's really grooving too. Okay, all right.
Outstanding!
But that's every wedding guest who wants a microphone. Never trust a wedding guest who wants to get on the mic.
Anybody with common sense wants to stay away from that.
Correct. There's a dance floor. Use it. We don't need to perform.
To be fair, though, do you really want to watch the dance floor either? I just think of my dad. When he dances on the wedding dance floor, he's got like a little flip of hair in the front. He looks like he's having a seizure. He's going crazy. He's having a blast, but I think he's the dancing version of that song.
You know what? If he's out there dancing, then the DJ is doing their job.
All right. Fair enough. I mean, it's no Gangnam Style, but...
Well, without further ado, Tom, let's end the program with a real song. This is not a recording we did today. This is the Real Earth, Wind & Fire. Happy September 21st, everyone. Happy fall. We'll be back next Saturday. Flashback Twin Cities, KLDB Club 1220.